You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Wednesday, May 8th, 2013, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Rebecca Watson.
Hello, everyone.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
And Evan Bernstein.
Buenas noches.
Hola.
What language is that?
You're really running out, Ev, right?
Yeah.
Next week, Evan's going to go, hello.
You went from Dothraki to Spanish.
It'll be howdy.
How do you say hello in Canadian?
Hello, eh?
Yeah. Exactly.
Right.
Hey, happy baby-free sex day, everybody.
Baby-free sex.
What is it?
I didn't get the memo
yeah.
on that.
All right. Well, it's a new holiday. I'm trying to get it going. It is to mark the occasion upon which in 1960, on May 11th, the FDA announced its approval of the use of Enovid, the first commercial oral contraceptive, which was previously, it had already been approved by the FDA, but like all of my friends in high school, it was approved only for controlling menstrual flow and related period problems.
I see.
Which, yeah, that's what all of my high school friends, quote unquote, took it for. Because it had already been approved, and at the time, the FDA only approved drugs based on whether or not they were safe, not on whether or not they were effective. And so it had already been proven safe because the FDA had already approved it. The company that produced the drug thought that it was going to be very easy to pass it. Searle is the company that produced it. However, they ended up facing a lot of backlash not because of the safety issues, but because of the moral issues. And in fact, some doctors, including an obstetrician and gynecologist named John Rock, who was a leading proponent of the pill, he had to travel to Washington to confront government officials over why they weren't approving the pill's application, and was faced with questioning that concerned the morality of allowing women to have sex without the punishment of children. However, he was successful. He and others who campaigned for the pill, they were successful. And, on this day in history, it was announced that it would be approved for use in preventing pregnancy, the first of its kind.
I once heard that characterized as separating the act of having sex from the act of having children. So you can have sex without having children. And then later we developed the technology of having children without having sex. Artificial insemination.
Well, the pill wasn't the start of that. You know, there were already condoms, but prior to the pill, there was no way for women to have control.
And it does seem quaint to think about the moral argument, you know, about contraception.
And yet today, you know, that fight is not won. We're still fighting today to allow, for instance, pharmacists. There are people in the religious right that are fighting for the right for pharmacists to withhold medicine from women because of their moral compunctions.
Well, before we go on to some news items, just want to say that we have a very interesting interview coming up later in the show with Don McElroy, the former chairman of the Texas School Board of Education, who led the fight for the strength and weaknesses type of language included in the science textbook standards. But first, Jay is going to tell us about
your kid's dead.
I mean, that's a funny way to start a horrible, partially horrible story. Yeah, this is formerly known as the kid's dead. No, he's not.
Part two.
On May 6th, 2013, amazingly, three people, one of them named Amanda Berry, a woman who had been kidnapped 10 years ago and held captive by a man named Ariel Castro's in Cleveland.
We should say allegedly because nothing's no convictions yet.
So like I said, she was kidnapped in 2003. She was 16 years old at the time. A year later, her mom, Luana Miller, asked Sylvia Brown on the Montel Williams show for help. You know, a lot of our listeners, I'm sure, are aware that when Montel Williams had his show, he had Sylvia Brown on quite a bit. Very popular segment for him and a guest for him to have on to give live readings to audience members. Random audience members would come deliberately just to get in front of Sylvia to get a reading from her. So Luana got a reading. She asked if her daughter will ever be found and if she was out there. And Sylvia Brown replied, "I hate this when they're in water. I just hate this. She's not alive, honey. And I'll tell you why. Here we go again. Your daughter was not the type that would not have called you." And of course, that's a very small part of what Sylvia said, but she told her that the woman's daughter was dead. This is not the first time Sylvia has been wrong or has made statements like this. And it's not just that she's wrong. This is far worse, and the kind of error that she made is loathsome.
Now, Jay, I'm not even sure it's accurate to call what she said an error. It's not like she made a mistake, that she was trying to get it right, or that there was any process that she didn't do properly. She knew exactly what she was doing. She was just saying whatever. She was playing the odds. She was saying things for drama, you know, just to promote herself. So this wasn't an error. She knew what she was doing. She doesn't care whether or not what she's saying is accurate or not.
I agree with you, Steve. In my opinion, she knows that she's lying. She's doing it for the attention, for ratings, and ultimately for money. To further that point, here's where, you know, I think it goes from selfish to absolute evil. She does this at the expense of other people's health, sanity, and in this case, you know, as I unfold the story here, somebody's life could have come into play because of what she said and the lies that she told. She's literally profiteering off of people's feelings about their own children.
Jay, if you read a lot of the people that are commenting on her, they call her, I think this is very appropriate, they call her a grief vampire.
Oh God, that is perfect.
Which I thought was beautiful.
That is perfect.
Wasn't that beautiful?
Yeah.
A grief vampire, exactly.
And I put myself in Miss Miller's position. She's emotionally compromised. She's reaching out to the, you know, in public, asking for help, on a TV show. You know, it's a very difficult thing to do. You know, you're reaching out to a perfect stranger who you think might be able to help solve this mystery about your missing, not confirmed dead, truly missing daughter for over a year. And what Sylvia Brown does is a train wreck of a walk all over Amanda Berry's mom. And she died in 2006. Now, a lot of her friends and family are saying that she died of a broken heart. You know, it's a tough thing to say, you know, can you actually die from a broken heart, from depression? I don't know the answer to that. But what I do know, and the facts are, that she died truly believing that her daughter was dead. And the fact was that her daughter wasn't dead at the time and still isn't dead.
You know, it's hard to say, of course, whether or not she would have survived longer if she, you know, was still clinging to hope that her daughter was alive. But she was looking for her daughter, who actually wasn't far from her home. And she gave, by account, she gave up looking for her daughter when Sylvia Brown told her that she was dead. And maybe if she hadn't given up, you know, she would have, something different would have happened. Again, who knows?
And let's be clear that that's something that was reported on back when she first met with Sylvia Brown. Afterward, there was a newspaper article, a local news article written about her in which it said, like, well, now I'm going to give up. This isn't just some post hoc thing. Well, she probably gave up after. She did.
And certainly a devastating psychological effect to her.
You know, she, soon after the meeting up with Sylvia and getting the information from her, she started to throw away her daughter's things, and she really was wrapping up, like, the hope. And what happened was the FBI still had an open case. They were still looking for her, for the daughter. She gave up before the FBI did. So Sylvia played a very strong emotional role in her, you know, decision to give up hope that her daughter was alive. And, like, I agree with you, Steve. Who knows what would have happened if the mother kept pushing? And you guys know this. This isn't the only time that she's done this. She's made this mistake many times.
I've got another one that I wasn't aware of. I mean, with this one you're talking about, Jay, at the very least, at the end of the day, you've got a good story in that she's alive. She's not dead. So, you know, there is that. I'm sure she went through hell and her mom died, and maybe she would have been found earlier, but she was still alive. But there was a story involving Sylvia that wasn't as good as this one. She another mother went to see Sylvia about her daughter Opal, who was missing.
Opal.
Sylvia says she said that her daughter Opal was taken and put into some kind of slavery thing and taken into Japan. The place is Kokoro. She even named the place. I mean, can you imagine? She pulls that out. I don't know where she pulled it from, but you know, your daughter's not dead, but she's a slave going through God knows what. And now eventually what happened was Opal was found dead, buried in Fort Worth, Texas. The pathologist said that she was murdered the night she went missing. So there was no way that she was a slave in Japan.
A former special FBI agent and now retired and works as a consultant for ABC News, Brad Garrett, said, as far as finding a victim, finding remains, finding evidence, or in any way helping to solve the case, it's never been my experience. So it's really a disservice to victims. He's talking in reference of using psychics to help solve cases.
Yeah.
And then I stumbled across this, and this blew my mind completely out the back of my head. Amanda Berry's cousin, Sherry Cole, reached out to Sylvia Brown and said offered love and support. And according to Brown's public relations rep, Cole reportedly told Brown that she wanted her to know that she's accurate in her description of the perpetrator. And I quote, our family in no way blames Sylvia. This doesn't change anything. We still love her and believe in her.
Ugh.
It doesn't get more ridiculous. Like, I don't, how much more ridiculous can this news item get?
Oh, but the alternative is, we were duped, and nobody wants to think that.
Yeah.
Right. And yet, Jay, I read a quote saying that her family said that she died, that the mother died of a broken heart after her hopes of a rescue were dashed by Brown's vision. So I'm having a hard time reconciling what you just said in this quote. But
and that's just her one sister, and that's reported by Sylvia Brown's PR company, right?
Okay. True.
If it's true that Sherry Cole said that, it could have been that the family was so elated that, you know, it was like no harm done, you know.
We're just happy to have her back, whatever, at this point.
But as I'm sitting there and I'm looking at Sylvia Brown's Facebook page, it's occurring to me, this is going to just blow over. You know, it's going to be a little blip on her radar.
Just like Sean Hornbeck. I mean, we all thought that was pretty huge when it happened. It was another... Mm-hmm. Another kid who Sylvia Brown told the family that he was dead, that his body was behind some rocks, far away in another state or something, I think. And then, of course, he was found in the same neighborhood, just like these women, like very close by, being held captive. It blew up. It was such a big deal. Anderson Cooper was running stories about Sylvia Brown, and look, what came of it? Nothing. She's still raking in the dough. People still love her. She's an unsinkable rubber ducky, as Randy would say.
And Montel Williams doesn't get off in my book either, because he allows someone like Brown to peddle her nonsense and her crap using his show as a vehicle, you know.
Because it was good for his ratings.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, definitely.
So I was just purely cynical.
Compliant in this as well.
All right, let's move on. Bob, tell us about cosmic rays and lightning.
I love when we learn something new and fundamental about a common phenomenon of nature. This may be the case with plain old lightning. You know, it may not be completely Earth-based event as we all think. It may actually require cosmic rays to initiate that awesome event that we call a lightning strike. Now, this wild-sounding theory was first posited by Russian physicist Alex Gurevich way back in the dark ages of, I think it was like 1992. And most recently, he and Anatoly Karashtin published a paper in the Real Journal of Physical Review Letters. I hate how I feel compelled to call it a real journal. Apparently, they have found more evidence to support this theory. This is really interesting. Now, if you ask most lightning-literate people what actually causes lightning to happen, they'll tell you something like, well, there's collision between ice and water caused by the winds in the upper atmosphere, and this wind acts as a way to separate the charges, the positive and negative charges. And the positive charges predominate in the crystals of ice, while the negative charges accumulate in heavier mixtures of water and ice. I think that's called Grapple, is that how you pronounce that? This mass difference causes the lighter material, of course, to be blown a lot higher than the heavier particles, and this is what does the separation of the charges and ultimately produces the lightning within the clouds or at the ground level. So that's like the common wisdom. That's what most people believe. That's what I thought. And what surprised me was that this theory isn't as well supported as you may think. That was really I really didn't know that. I thought that was pretty ironclad. No one has proved it with the level of confidence that you may think. Apparently, the complexity of storms and lightning makes it really, really hard to find out exactly what's going on. So what are these guys talking about? What's their theory? And this is where cosmic rays come in. These are very highly energetic particles. They're mostly protons. They can be incredibly powerful, 100 to 1,000 tera electron volts, which is more energy than any particles that we know of. And they're created by huge astronomical events like black holes, gamma ray bursts, or supernova. Now, the theory is about what happens after these cosmic ray particles intersect with our planet and interact with our atmosphere. Energetic cosmic rays, essentially, they turn into less energetic shower of particles when they collide with our atmosphere, which is good because you don't want raw cosmic rays hitting us and the Earth.
Oh, yeah.
Now, the cosmic rays or their daughter particles hit, for example, waters of droplets in clouds. And this
or droplets of water.
No, water of droplets, that's right.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Okay. Good
Shakespearean.
Point.
I like it.
Now, this ionizes the atmosphere, essentially ripping away electrons. And these newly freed electrons are then amped up in two specific ways. They're brought to higher energies by the electric field that already exists in the cloud. And the electrons also collide with more water molecules, creating yet more free electrons. And it also produces X-rays and gamma rays. So basically you have this torrent of high energy electrons, and this creates what's called, they call it a runaway breakdown, which is what we call a lightning bolt. So there it is. So that's the theory as it was.
It's also a Jennifer Aniston movie.
Oh God. So that's the theory as it was back in 92. So what's really new? There's not a lot to say that's new, but it is very, very interesting. So the scientists realized that if lightning was caused by cosmic rays, that there should be a detectable radio waves. So they set up their measuring devices and they looked at over 3,000 lightning strikes, and they found tons of radio emissions that were detected just as the lightning formed. And so the real icing on the cake here was, though, that these radio emissions matched projections that Gurevich made years and years ago. So it's actually looking really good. That, can you imagine, lightning is really caused by cosmic rays and not really what we thought they were caused by. And I'm really curious to see if they can get more supporting evidence for this and find other ways to support it. And who knows, maybe in a few years or so, it'll be common wisdom that, and everyone kind of knows that, oh yeah, lightning is caused by cosmic ray particles coming from outer space. How cool is
that? I say that one's the fiction.
I don't know. That kind of makes sense. I mean, you know, high energy particles slamming into our upper atmosphere. Why wouldn't that be related to lightning? Bob, you've heard of dark energy, of course, right?
Yes.
And dark matter. Mm-hmm. Have you ever heard of dark lightning?
Yes. Actually, that was in the news like last week.
Yeah.
I did read about it.
But dark lightning is a burst of gamma rays produced during thunderstorms by extremely fast-moving electrons colliding with air molecules.
Well, there you go. That fits right in. Yes. There because when these ionized particles, when these electrons hit the water, they, like I said, they create X-rays and gamma rays.
Yeah, so it's a gamma ray burst. Yeah.
So all right, so it's a gamma ray component of the electrons. Excellent. That's that are produced by the electrons. Sweet.
Okay, one more news item.
So I did know it.
Because I want to leave time for the interview. Evan, you're going to tell us what that annoying sound is in the background.
The annoying sound in the background that you hear? Well, just open your window on any given day if you're in the northeastern part of the United States and it's late May or early June, and you'll hear cicadas. Not just any cicadas, though.
Is it cicadas or cicadas?
Okay, so there's a whole section here about how to pronounce it. And there are multiple pronunciations for it.
Or cicadas.
You can pronounce it cicada. You can call it cicada. There's also cicada and cicada. So there's four ways to pronounce it. I'm going with cicada.
I like cicada. Yeah.
I do too.
You say cicada, I say cicada.
So what's the... Evan, what's the point?
Well, let me tell you a little story. I'll make it quick, Steve. One score less 3 years ago, Brood 2 engulfed the northeastern United States. Now, Brood 2 was not a single-player shooter game based on StarCraft. Brood 2 is when billions of magicicadas crawl out from under the ground up to the surface.
Wait, billions? And, is it billions?
Oh, Bob, the estimates are as high as 30 billion of these creatures.
Whoa.
Of these little bugs come to the surface. And, yeah, I read many estimates on it, but they think it's as high as 30 billion. Some even said maybe more and we don't really know. But, I like 30 billion. That's a nice round number. Every 17 years, and when something in the insect world happens once every 17 years, that is newsworthy in science. So every 17 years, the magic cicadas sprout to the surface to mate, hatch their offspring, and it starts the cycle anew. And the Brood 2 is covering an area stretching from Connecticut to North Carolina. It's a nice big swath of area, and certainly a lot of people live in that region too. And so what have they been doing for the last 17 years? Well, they've been burrowed underground, feeding off of tree roots. And these insects are about 4 millimeters in length. They do not bite animals, which includes people, and they do not sting. So there's no fear of being injured by them unless you happen to find yourself in the center of a large swarm in which they are chirping their mating song. And when they get going all at the same time, the decibel levels reach them, in some cases, the mid-90s. And there are even estimates saying that it breaks the 100 decibel mark.
Wow.
If you had long-term exposure to that, you could suffer some kind of hearing damage, but, you know, you're probably still going to be okay in the long run. So this is a special time, you know, every 17 cool. years. I mean, how?
So do you know why it's 17 years?
That's to do with like moisture content under the ground or something.
All right. So periodic cicadas have cycles of either 13 or 17 years. And there is a theory as to why that is the duration. Why 13 and 17? Why not something else?
There's a theory that I've heard has recently been if not disproved, there's really no more evidence for it, I think. But the idea that they've evolved that way to protect themselves from enemies, because they don't really have any defenses. So the best they can do is just sprout all at once in a giant cloud and, you know, in the hopes of enough of them surviving until the next cycle.
Right.
Strength in numbers.
Because the other animals who eat them just get gorged and they just can't eat them all. So, but also, and 13 and 17, because they are prime numbers.
Yes, prime numbers.
Yeah, so another species can't sync up with them. And also different populations of cicadas are out of sync with each other. And right. because it's 13 and 17 years, they're not like multiples of each other. So they won't ever sync up.
I don't get what you mean, sync up, Steve. What?
So, like, if it was 6 and 12 years, then every other cycle,
every
they'd be at the same time. And other species can't adapt to such an odd number cycle, you know? You know what I mean? It's like another species, if they were really prepared for the cicadas to come out, then they could eat a lot of them. But by
going with a prime number, it makes it a lot harder.
No, the predators can't rely upon this cycle. And, so it does sort of take them by surprise and then overwhelm them with sheer numbers so that.
Well, Steve, how could they rely on almost any cycle? I mean, what if it was just 4 years? I mean, or 7 or 9 years or 8? How could they adapt to that? Would they just don't eat for 4 years, or they're like, well, we got a big meal coming, so don't worry about how hungry you are right now. You know, how could they, right?
Well, the idea is that if the predator species had a cycle population, and it was divisible into the cicada rhythm, that they would get an occasional population boost. Like maybe every other or every third cycle, there would be a lot more food for them, and their that would overall increase the predator population. And the other reason for it is, again, so that different broods, different cicada populations, don't cycle together or emerge at the same time, because then they would mix their genes, and then that would result in intermediate times. So if they want to keep their populations distinct and all cycling right at once, then they have to not emerge at the same time, different populations emerging at the same time. Also, the other issue is that the Wikipedia page is a little bit wrong here. It says that this theory is replaced by one that says that it has to do with the colder climates during the Pleistocene. But what they're confusing here is that is the reason given for the large prime numbers, 13 and 17, rather than smaller prime numbers like 7. The thinking there is that during the Ice Age, that if a brood emerged during a cold snap, it could wipe out the entire population. And so those populations with the larger life cycles, the longer life cycles, 17 years, there were fewer opportunities for that to happen. And so they tended to predominate over time.
Well, the most important question for me is, are we going to see them here in Connecticut?
Chances are, yes, we will see them in Connecticut. And
there are already reports in Connecticut.
That's right. Exactly right. Yes, they have been seen already from the stretch of North Carolina up to Connecticut. So the ground temperature needs to reach 64 degrees Fahrenheit at 8 inches depth. Specifically,
okay.
That's exactly so. Connecticut is just now approaching that level at the eight inch depth. They're already in New York, and certain parts of Connecticut have just started to reach there. So in the next week or two, here we go. You want five quick facts about cicadas? I could run
sure,
through these real quick
if they're cool.
Probably that you didn't know. Sure. Number one, cicadas make their mating noise during daylight hours only. There's no nighttime hanky panky going on. Number two, the Humane Society warns against allowing your pets, especially dogs, to gorge on yardfuls of cicadas. They can be a choking hazard, and
oh
they have hard shells made of chitin, and in large amount it clogs up the digestive system of the animals. Number three, you can eat them, and they're described as tasting like asparagus, popcorn, or pine cones. Now, who would eat a pine cone?
Pine cones.
Who would eat asparagus?
Who would eat a cicada, guys?
Oh,
come on.
I hate asparagus.
Can you fry them up?
Anybody who's hungry.
Oh, you can dip them in chocolate. German chocolate cicada.
That's it. I'm going to fry up a cicada.
I've heard that crickets and things are very delicious. So
no,
I bet
no.
A cicada would be good.
If I find a cicada in my yard, I will fry it up and eat it.
What?
Sweet. Take a picture of it.
And you have to report on that. Yes.
Since when do we eat bugs?
Maybe you can find a recipe online.
When do we eat bugs? Why? Why?
What's wrong with eating bugs?
Protein.
Bugs is, what do they call it? They're micro, husbandry. Yeah, they actually are very protein dense, very nutritious, and you can get a lot of food out of a very small area. Insects mm-hmm. are really good food and are staples and for many people around the world.
Ah, I'm so glad.
Sure.
Yeah,
but locust
Steve,
swarms in the deserts
we have
and stuff,
supermarkets
like, that's a bounty to them.
With steak. You don't need to eat bugs, man.
Who would eat a cow?
It's a proof of concept more than
a that's okay. Such a first world bias. Joke.
Big, inefficient,
Steve,
not good.
Ice cream.
Unhealthy.
Steve, eat one. Eat one, Steve. If it tastes like asparagus, I won't join you. But if it tastes like popcorn, I will.
All right. I'll.
Yeah, well, it doesn't taste like a pine cone, for God's
guys,
sake.
Guys.
Disgusting. Two more quick facts, guys. Number four, they are notoriously bad flyers. They often run into things, and sometimes they can't even get off the ground at all. So their wings, you know, not the best in the
bummer.
World. And last but not least, an anagram for cicadas is dick sack.
Ha! There you go. Oh, you want to eat a dick sack,
okay.
Steve. Nice.
You know.
And also, if you guys are fans of Radiolab, then you know that they have a cicada tracker mm-hmm. that you can find at project.wnyc.org/cicadas. And if you're on the East Coast, you can go on and you can mark down when you first spot or hear a cicada, and there's a map there, and mm-hmm. you can see how they spread.
Cool.
Yeah.
Yeah, we'll follow up on it, see if we learn anything this cycle. And if anybody has any really good cicada recipes out there, please email me.
Guys, I'd like to see the, imagine the first one that comes out and the last one that comes out.
Yeah.
I don't know why I'm thinking about that.
You would want to be the very last one.
Number one.
Whoa.
And number 30 billion. Yeah, right.
All right, Evan. Who's that noisy?
So, I will play for you last week's Who's That Noisy? And here we go. For those of you who have forgotten, I will play it for you one more time.
Sound like Jay a little bit.
It did sound like Jay a little bit, but that's not the right answer.
He was counting up to 100. Could barely hear him.
Because it's a rather old recording.
I figured
That was the voice of Alexander Graham Bell. I mean, that's old.
Whoa, cool.
That's
very cool.
Little Alex.
His voice was recorded on a wax-covered cardboard disc. Cardboard on April 15th. He recorded on April 15th, 1885. And he gave it an audio signature called Hear My Voice, Alexander Graham Bell. This disc stood unplayed for 128 years as part of the Smithsonian Museum's collection of early recorded sound. That is until digital imaging came along and computer science and new technology allowed us to finally hear what was recorded on there.
I think the new Vampire Weekend album is being released on a
wax on cardboard
yeah. disc. Yeah.
Did he use a needle to play it back?
At the time, their experimental nature and fragile condition made them unsuitable for playback. It may not have been played back at the time, Jay. There may not have been a good means to do so.
He recorded it until the digital technology existed to make a copy of it.
He's like an early, what's that thing where you, like that Jay's doing where you freeze your head?
Yeah.
What?
Cryonics.
Yeah. Cryonics. It sounds audio cryonics.
Audio cryonics.
Like vocalonics or something? What are you talking?
I think audio cryonics is a better term, but. It's just my
point. Voconics. Voconics.
Well,
thank you.
Well, I've coined it. Voconics. This way.
You can make a different recording device out of sticky tape. That's, tape and iron filings.
Cool.
Seen that done on TV.
Cool. Think about it. We had to wait till the technology evolved in which Berkeley created a lab scanner that can capture gigapixels of information, right, Bob? Not just width and height, but depth of the groove with measurements down to 100 nanometers, which is 250 times smaller than the width of a human hair. So we had to wait till we got to that level of technology.
Is it nanometers or nanometers?
not again.
Nanometers. How's that?
Good. Did anybody get that?
Actually, several people did get it. And from all those correct guesses, we drew the name, and Chu from the message boards is this week's winner. Well done, Chu.
Hey, Chu.
Chewy.
Chewy. We haven't heard your name in a while. It's good to hear from you, and congratulations. Well done.
All right. What do you got for this week?
I know what it is. It's the noise of someone yelling for help and after they swallowed a kazoo.
This better not be another depressing one like those beavers that were dying in a fire.
That was terrible.
I've moved away from suffering animal noises and gone with the more what could be described as cute and adorable noises. Wouldn't you say that that's a cute and adorable noise?
So long as it's not dying in a fire, then yeah.
Not that I'm aware of.
I know. Rebecca, I got to tell you, that haunted me. That hurt me for a couple of weeks. Yeah. Like, that poor little guy.
I'm obviously still scarred.
Wow. Boy.
I have PTSD.
I didn't realize. Yeah. Just don't sue me or anything, okay? I mean, I'm just the messenger here.
Hey.
WTN@theskepticsguide.org is the email, or our message boards, sguforums.com. Give it your best guess. Good luck, everyone.
All right. Thanks, Evan. Well, let's go on with our interview. Joining us now is Don McElroy. Don, welcome to The Skeptic's Guide.
Hey, thank you very much for the invitation.
And Dr. McElroy is the former chairman of the Texas School Board of Education. He is a working dentist. He also has a Bachelor of Science degree in Electrical Engineering from Texas A&M University. And Don, you're probably best known to our listeners as being at the center of the Texas science textbook controversy from a few years ago. Why don't you tell us about your involvement in that?
Okay, I'd be glad to. It was 4 years ago that Texas State Board of Education adopted new science standards. The standards is what they'll write the textbooks to. So the big controversy over science and evolution was the standards that we adopted 4 years ago. And I proposed two standards that were adopted that require the textbook writers provide scientific explanations concerning sudden appearance, stasis, and sequential nature pattern of fossils in the fossil record, and scientific explanations concerning the complexity of the cell.
And why did you feel that was necessary?
Well, I just felt it's necessary because it completes the teaching of evolution. I think evolution has evidentiary problems explaining both the fossil record and the development of the complexity of the cell. And evidently, Science Magazine, they reported on it within the next issue, that new Texas science standards strike a major blow to the teaching of evolution. So they must have agreed that it was significant.
Well, that doesn't necessarily imply that they agree with your criticism, though, right? They just thought the standards...
Oh, no. I don't. Of course not. They didn't. They didn't agree. They just reported that it struck a major blow to the teaching of evolution.
Okay, and that was your intention?
Well, my intention was to have the kids to restore scientific integrity, from my point of view, to restore scientific integrity to the teaching of evolution. I saw the necessity of, you know, having more complete coverage. And frankly, we were justified because just last year, Fordham Institute did a analysis of all the state standards. We're not talking textbooks. We're talking about the curriculum standards across the nation. And they reported just one little over 1 year ago that the Texas coverage of evolution in the high school course was exemplary. So they kind of confirmed the fact that we did put some good, legitimate scientific standards in. And the other thing I'd be glad to mention is the fact that they have not been challenged in court. I had no intention, and we had no intention on the board, to insert any kind of intelligent design or creationism. We just wanted to have a more complete evaluation, looking at the evidence that people can provide for the fossil record and the development of the complexity of the cell.
So before we get to the question of evidence, let's talk about that, the notion that it was not your intent to introduce intelligent design or creationist arguments into Texas science standards. The perception by those who oppose your amendments is that, well, this is backdoor creationism, that the purpose of this is to put pressure on textbook publishers to introduce what are traditionally creationist pseudoscientific or unscientific arguments against evolution, but that do not represent the scientific consensus. And therefore, in fact, you know, although perhaps coy, that this is, in fact, an attempt at introducing creationism into public schools.
Well, I know that's what they said, but they were inaccurate. We got 4 years of time-tested standards in place right now that prove that they were wrong. I got exactly what I wanted. The board passed standards to have, I'd have to say, are exactly legitimate science. It's really interesting. Eugenie Scott with the National Center for Science Education at the time said that the injection of these standards were a real, I got it right here, that these amendments were intelligent design talking points. And she said, let's be clear about this, cautioned Scott. This is a setback for science education in Texas, not a draw. Well, if that's what they were, that's what she said at the time when we passed these standards. She was there. She was at the meeting. We passed these standards. They have proven to be the test, you know, they've proven by 4 years to be legitimate scientific standards. They haven't been challenged in court. Therefore, if they are, it's what she would be arguing. I could make a logical deduction that the intelligent design would be legitimate science because she said these standards were intelligent design talking points. Then, they haven't been challenged in court. They're legitimate. Fordham called them exemplary. Well, you put those two together, then you'd have to say, well, intelligent design talking points are legitimate science.
Well, I'm not sure that I would agree that that follows.
Well, I know you won't, but
it just means that they haven't been challenged in court. That doesn't mean that they're legitimate science. I mean, and Eugenie Scott was concerned about how this would be enacted. I mean, you know, these kinds of laws, the devil is always in how they are actually employed. Cause, you know, the standards say you have to introduce, you know, intelligent design talking points into textbooks. It was just the fear that would be the result, right?
Yeah. Right. But the part that really, I think, put the icing on the cake was a year ago when the Fordham report described them as exemplary. And yeah, it's not fair to say, well, they haven't been challenged in court. You know, that's not really, that really won't go very far.
Yeah.
Logically, I guess. But I do think it does show that, they were legitimate science because, you know, this is an important issue. If there was any kind of religion in the standards or any kind of intelligent design, they would have been probably challenged in court. I can't say for sure they would, but it seems to me everything they pretty quick to take it to court if you were putting in some kind of religion. And yes, I'm a creationist. Of course, I'm a creationist. But frankly, I think my being a creationist, being religious creationist like I am, actually, it gives me the opportunity to examine evolution and look at the evidence and either accept or reject it. Kenneth Miller, a very religious, fine man, he looks at the evidence and he accepts evolution. I look at the evidence and I don't accept it. I reject it. And, but you know, those that are atheistic or something like that, they're the ones that are in a box because they can only accept evolution. So.
Well, why would you say that?
The atheist?
Yeah.
Well, maybe not 100%, but, I would say because if they were to, what's the alternative to, evolution or, you know, the only naturalistic explanation out there that I know of. And if you get away from that, then you get into the supernatural, and atheists wouldn't believe in the supernatural. At least that's the way I understand an atheist.
Well, I mean, atheism is certainly a worldview that tends to accept philosophical naturalism and materialism, but science as a endeavor puts evidence and logic above everything else. We basically accept what the evidence shows us. We certainly do find it pretty incredible that you would claim that somebody who has a firmly held religious belief is more free to examine scientific evidence than somebody who specifically rejects any ideology or any belief in favor of science and evidence. Doesn't that seem contradictory?
Oh gosh, no. I mean, I'm a very religious person, but the reason that I reject evolution is on the evidence, not on my religious beliefs.
Well, again, that's hard to believe. I mean, I have to say. And you were religious before you rejected evolution, or what was the sequence of events?
I had never thought about it. I never really cared. You know, I never really paid much attention at the time. I assumed evolution was possibly true. And, you know, this is before I became a Christian. And so I assumed the scientists, the experts knew what they were talking about, but I never looked into it. When I started to look into it, I started saying, wait, maybe there's some problems here.
I just want to go back to this idea that atheists can only believe in evolution because anything else is a supernatural explanation, and so then therefore they're biased. Maybe it would help to put that into perspective by pointing out that the only explanation for the Earth going around the sun and not vice versa, an atheist can only believe in heliocentrism because anything else would be a supernatural explanation. Do you see how that doesn't really follow? What you're saying is that all of the evidence we have is pointing towards evolution, and therefore people who do not believe in supernatural explanations can only accept that.
Actually, what I would say, Rebecca, is the fact that from my religious position, I'm in a freer position to be able to accept or reject the evidence that I see for evolution, and I think it's harder than for the atheist. I think you're clarifying it for me, and I appreciate that.
Yeah, well, as an atheist, I would disagree. That's all. And I think Rebecca's point is that, well, the only thing that really defines our worldview is that we follow the evidence scientifically.
Okay, well, I'm with following the evidence.
Yeah. So, and Rebecca's other point, I think, is very legitimate, is that you could say the same thing about absolutely every scientific conclusion. Why single out evolution if it isn't a particular point of religious dogma for you?
Well, evolution does bring a lot of, other ideas and where we came from, where we're going, you know, another really important crucial ideas that kind of get brought in with evolution. That's why.
Yeah, but not plate tectonics, for example. I mean, that's not a hot button issue for creationists.
My question is very genuine. I'm interested to know, when we talk about the experts, and one of your comments during the film was that, you know, someone has to challenge the experts. And I'd like to talk a little bit on that, because it really made me uncomfortable when you said that, because it seems obvious to me that when we give someone a designation of an expert in a particular field, that we're acknowledging that they have reached a level of understanding in that field where they have more knowledge of it than we do. And for you to say, you know, we have to question the experts, in a way, you're putting yourself in a position where you're claiming that you know more than they do and you can trump whatever their conclusions are. And I find that to be very, troubling. It just doesn't seem to be logical. So how do you explain that?
Well, you know, I think one thing I like about America is that we've been taught to think for ourselves. And just because everybody says something all the time and they are the quote experts in the field, I'll never forget Stephen Jay Gould talked about the bandwagon effect. You know, it's real easy to get on the bandwagon. Scientific consensus has been wrong many times in the past. I think it was Galileo even that said all it takes is one fact to stand up to whatever the scientific consensus is. And science is bred on skepticism. I think it was kind of saying I want to stand up to the experts. I had looked at the evidence, and I sat there, and I think they had a blind spot. Charles Walcott, you know, when he discovered the Burgess shell, he realized that he didn't realize what he was looking at, because he had his preconceived notions. And I've looked, and there are a lot of experts that I do agree with. I mean, in the scientific fields. I don't think you all agree with them, but I do. I mean, I've read their stuff. And so when I blurted that out at the meeting, it was right when it looked like we were about to lose all these things that we've been battling for. The first vote came up on the fossil record to put in sudden appearance and stasis, and we lost the vote. And that's when I knew we were going to lose the vote, and that's kind of when I made my little impassioned plea, and that kind of popped out of my mouth, and I had thought it a lot. I don't know that I want to go boasting about standing up, but I had said it, so it came out from my heart. But it turned out about 30 minutes later, there was some change of wording, and we ended up passing and putting sudden appearance and stasis into the record. So, but anyway, yeah, I agree with you. It sounds awfully arrogant and boastful, but I've been studying this for over 35 years. I've been reading, and I read your books. I mean, I read the I've read Dawkins's books. I've read Stephen Jay Gould's books, and I'm going, how come these guys are so blind? And I think it'll come out if we talk about the evidence, where I see the problems.
I mean, I just thought, just to finish up this point, I think where you have been criticized for saying that statement, somebody has to stand up for these experts. To us, that was like the statement that represents everything that's wrong with your approach, in that, you know, there's not every scientific consensus is equal. There are some consensus which is built upon, you know, 150 years, mountains of evidence, and that's been picked apart and analyzed 100 different ways and has withstood every possibility of refutation. That's a consensus that deserves to be given a lot of respect and not casually tossed aside because we can't understand it. So that's what it seems like to those of us on the side of science.
Even so, even though I said that, stand up to the experts. When we adopt standards, we had a meeting in January. We adopted the final standards in March. In January, I popped out of nowhere a standard that challenged the sudden fossil record and including sudden appearance and stasis. It passed, and then a week or two before the second meeting, I said, "Well, I'm gonna go ahead and put one in about the complexity of the cell." And so I actually was able to write an editorial in the Austin newspaper. I put it out there that I was going to propose a new one. I wanted to be honest. I wanted people to get their best shot to criticize it. To me, I don't see why the evolutionists don't put these standards in here. That's the data of the fossil record, of sudden appearance and stasis, and sequential nature pattern. The complexity of the cell is very complex, and when we get to the evidence, I think it'll show up why I stood up to the experts.
Well, it's a matter of emphasis. I mean, are we going to spend a lot of time talking about why the Earth-centered solar system is incorrect? I mean, things need to be given their appropriate amount of time and attention in a high school science class, and what you choose to emphasize certainly sends a powerful message to students, don't you think?
Well, that's exactly why I did it. I think we need to emphasize the problem evolution has in explaining the complexity of the cell, the development of the complexity of the cell. Yes. I agree 100%.
although the scientific community disagrees with you, so the question is whose consensus of opinion should predominate in terms of what we emphasize at the high school level? The 95% of scientists who have dedicated their lives and careers to studying evolutionary biology, or a dentist from Texas? I mean, I think that's what the world sees.
And I'll just give you an example. In the standard that students are supposed to analyze and evaluate scientific explanations concerning the complexity of the cell, Kenneth Miller has already submitted a textbook that's been adopted by the board 2 years ago, and he takes seven pages to describe, you know, how evolution explains the complexity of the cell, and it's stunningly weak. You know, Science Magazine, 2 months after we adopted the standards, ran a second story about the passing of our standards, and they have Kenneth Miller quoted as saying that this gives us the opportunity to show the robustness of evolutionary theory. So he's not, doesn't seem to be as worried as you all would be. But, well, that's wrong. I take that back. I'm sorry.
That's okay.
He just has a chance to give the robustness of evolution theory. And I was quoted in that story as saying this will give the opportunity for the students to see the weaknesses for themselves. And actually, I said skeptic. I used your all's word. I said those who are skeptical of evolution will be able to see the weaknesses for themselves. And so what we have done is, our students will get to decide. It's not Don McElroy or anybody else. They're going to look at the evidence presented, for instance, like by Kenneth Miller, and see what evidence does he provide in his cell. I mean, in his book about the development of the complexity of the cell.
Why don't we go there? Because this is all centers around ultimately what the evidence actually is. Now, none of us on this discussion are evolutionary biologists. We're all lay people trying to understand what a very complicated science actually has to say. But let's talk about it. So tell us what you think. First of all, we could start, since you've brought it up, the complexity of the cell. But then I'd also like to hear what you think is the biggest evidence against evolution. But let's tell us first why you think the complexity of the cell calls into question evolutionary theory.
Oh, okay. Thank you. Well, first of all, I'll tell you what I mean by evolution so we don't, everybody's get it clear. For me, evolution is the idea that all life is descended from a common ancestor as a result of unguided natural processes. Therefore, evolution is, even Darwin, they talk about life had already came into existence. So you're not talking about the origin of life. We're talking about the development of life. I, just over the holidays, well, back at Christmas holidays, I read two books. I read one by Why Evolution is True by Jerry Coyne. Mm-hmm. And I read Richard Dawkins, The Greatest Show on Earth. And I read both of them. And I read all the whole book, and I was highlighting it on my Kindle. But one thing I was looking forward to see what evidence did they give for the development of biochemical complexity of the cell. And I wrote a little critique, sent it to Jerry Coyne. He actually, about a month ago, he wrote a whole blog post on it. It got over 200 comments with people. And I was challenging to give evidence for the complexity of the cell. And bottom line, in his book, he talks about the development of the complexity of the cell. He only gives one little fact. Frankly, it was embarrassingly weak. He says that complex biochemical pathways is, the development of these biochemical pathways is not easy because they leave no trace in the fossil record. Okay, so then I ask, how many details does he provide? He only provides one detail, and he says, quote, the common ancestor of sea cucumbers and vertebrates had a gene that was later co-opted in vertebrates as fibrinogen. If that's all the evidence that he can come up with for that entire 27 square feet of biochemical pathways, and I'd say, well, that's weak.
Well, is that fair, though? I mean, was that really, was he just giving an example? I mean, was he actually saying that that's the only example? I could think of other examples off the top of my head, and I'm not a biochemist or an evolutionary biologist. I mean, the evolution of the vitamin C pathway between primates and humans and other mammals is another example. I mean, there's a ton of them.
He says evolutionists need not take on the impossible challenge of pinning down every detail of like flagellar evolution or some of the others when he's talking about this complexity.
Right.
But anyway, but if you look for the specific facts, the only fact that he includes in his book and then later on his blog in responding to my post when he put on there, he says, of course, biochemical complexity must underlie all the morphological complexity. Mitochondria and chloroplast, this is from The Greatest Show. Dawkins. He says, mitochondria and chloroplast descended from different kinds of bacteria. Each built up their complementary chemical wizardries billions of years before the existence of any living organism visible to the naked eye. Well, that's not evidence. And he makes a similar statement. They're just statements. It's not evidence. And so.
Well, but that's, okay, so you're talking about, first of all, popular writing to the public, not the technical literature. And they're summarizing our current synthesis of knowledge. So what it seems to me what you're doing is you're focusing on something like biochemical evolution at the cellular level, the biochemical level, and saying, where's the evidence for the specific evolution of biochemical pathways? But that's not offered by scientists as a strong area of evidence for evolution, precisely because it is not something that fossilizes. It's not something about which we can have a large set of strong evidence. We have to do the best we can with the evidence
exactly
that we have. But that's not where the strong evidence for evolution is. You're deliberately focusing on the weakest evidence because that's the hardest for us to see. So the here's my question. Is the evidence for the specific evolution of the cell, the complexity of the cell, weak because it's just an area where it's difficult to find evidence because biochemical process don't follow.
That's true.
Or because evolution is wrong. It seems like the implication that you're drawing is that, well, the evidence is weak, therefore evolutionary theory must be weak, but rather it's the evidence in that particular area is weak because that's just where the light is dimmest. We don't expect to see really good evidence there because that's not something that fossilizes.
Well, people ought to go to Jerry Coyne's blog, Why Evolution is True, and see the responses to the challenge that I gave them. And there, Jerry Coyne did say that all this biochemical complexity must underlie all the morphological complexity. So I think it's a fair challenge, and I think it's that's why I think it's weak. And I'm just letting the Texas students, they can read the textbooks, they can study this for themselves, and they can decide for themselves, is this evidence strong or weak? So to me, it's very fair. I think they have a tough time explaining it. But Kenneth Miller, in his book, the one thing I like about Kenneth Miller, he takes on the challenges. He knows what the intelligent design folks have challenged. Right. So he talks about the flagellum, the development, that, because he knows that's what maybe the kids are going to read. But he also, you know, one of the intelligent design and creationists loved to talk about, well, how did you get a ribosome? You know, so he takes these things head on in his 7 pages of talking about the complexity of the cell. Yeah. But listen to what he actually put in the book. He's talking about, he admits that it's long been a mystery. Then he says this, quote, this is from the textbook submission that he has made for the Texas school books. He says, thus, it seems likely that the earliest cells may have produced proteins using RNA alone. So it says, seems likely and may have using RNA alone. Over time, ribosomal proteins were gradually added to these protein-producing RNAs in a way to stabilize the structure, increasing both the efficiency and complexity of the process. In other words, he says, do we know which protein was the first one added to some RNA? Do they know what was the second one, the third one? There's like 80 different proteins usually, you know, in a ribosome. Mm-hmm. But then at the end of that, he says, therefore, the complexity of today's ribosome is the result of evolutionary process that started with simple RNA molecules.
Well, I think you're confusing two things. You're confusing evidence for the fact that life on Earth is the product of organic evolution and we have common ancestry with evidence for specific details of what evolved from what, how, and when. And you're not only doing that, but you're focusing on the hardest thing for us to know about because it's something that leaves the least amount of evidence behind. So you're rigging the game. And further, it seems to me you're making the typical God of the gaps argument. So in that the fact that our current evidence for the details of the evolution of biochemical complexity is thin is not evidence against evolution. It's not evidence for creation, for intelligent design. It simply reflects the fact that that's where the current evidence is weakest. And by focusing on that, that seems like you're trying to rig the game to a particular conclusion, not what does all of the evidence tell us if we look at it objectively?
Well, yeah, I do focus on where I think it's the weakest, and that's why would I pick some place where it's strong, you know? I mean, the sequential nature pattern of fossils, to me, is the strongest evidence. You know, when we first did this way back in 2003, I noticed you, when I got appointed chairman, you commented on the thing I had written way back then. And by the way, that was about a six-month project of reading all the books and underlining it. I didn't cut and paste anything. I was just trying to logically organize it. But anyway, that historical reality thing right. that you talked about several years ago. But what I'm talking about is not a God of the gaps. I'm talking about, if I'd have been putting God, that would have been religion. We're not putting religion in there. I'm just looking at the actual evidence. But at that time, and I still believe it, I came to realize that the strongest evidence, and I think it's very strong evidence, by the way, and I even mentioned it at the board meetings, the strongest evidence I see for people accepting evolution is the sequential nature pattern of groups in the fossil record. You look at the old phylogenetic trees, in the oldest rocks are simple organisms. That's the younger the rocks get, they get more complex. You know, finally get to the dinosaurs, and you finally get to man. It's very logical. It's very rational to assume that those organisms gradually change to these organisms, and these gradually change to these, and therefore that's where we came for today. I think that's very, very strong. The problem with that of the fossil record is there's two other patterns that are in the fossil record, and I'm very disappointed in the National Academy of Science, Kenneth Miller, Jerry Coyne, and all these people because they're doing card stacking now with their evidence. For instance, the National Academy of Science, in their latest book, Science, Evolution, and Creationism, in 2008, They don't mention stasis. They don't mention sudden appearance. Kenneth Miller, in his book Only a Theory, he doesn't mention stasis or sudden appearance. Jerry Coyne, in one paragraph, if he's just, you go to his chapter on fossils, just in just one paragraph, he talks about fossils that are 600 million years old, and he talks about that. Then he jumps to 400 million years old in the exact same paragraph. Well, what did he skip over? The Cambrian explosion, one of the greatest difficulties. He's card stacking. He's presenting half truths. He's not giving all the evidence. The National Academy of Science is card stacking. They're not giving us all the evidence. They don't tell these folks.
Well, I think you're cherry picking. I mean, I've read every popular book on evolution that there is, and there are entire books, you know, dedicated to this. I don't see how it's.
Oh, right. I'm just talking about what Jerry Coyne did in his recent book in 2009. Yeah. But yeah, there's been a lot of discussion by evolutionists of the Cambrian explosion to explain it. I'm just telling you an example that right there he doesn't cover it.
The response to that is a few things. Let me just, you know, address some of the things that you
said. Yeah, go ahead.
So in the Cambrian explosion, you characterize that as sudden, but that means 5 to 10 million years is what you're calling sudden. It's maybe sudden, you know, geologically, but that's still a lot amount of time. And also, we're talking about the sudden appearance of hard parts in the fossil record. Again, the soft parts don't fossilize very well, so there's very good reason to think, in what little evidence that we do have, that the evolution of multicellular life, which is what the Cambrian explosion was, actually was, it was simmering along for even a lot longer. And then when, once hard parts were developed, then of course they suddenly, you know, meaning over millions of years, appear in the fossil record. So that's not a problem.
I think that's great.
Not a problem for evolution.
I don't
see that that's being hidden anywhere. And then you also, again, like sudden appearance and stasis. Again, it's a matter of emphasis and not putting things into its proper context. Sudden with, you know, species appear suddenly in the fossil record. But again, that's 5 to 50,000 years for a speciation event. That's sudden geologically, but not sudden in terms of the proper amount of time for a speciation event to occur in evolution. And then creatures, you know, the current synthesis is, you know, punctuated equilibrium. Species are at equilibrium with their environment. They tend to just track environment rather than going extinct or evolving. When their environment changes, they move to find an environment that fits them better. And so they tend to be at morphological stasis with their environment until another speciation event occurs or they go extinct. So that's not an incompatible pattern with evolution. So I'm not sure why you're bringing that up, as if it is somehow calling to question evolution.
Well, the reason to bring it up, to me, it's very weak. I mean, the
what's
whole
weak
idea
about
is kind of like they moved the goalpost a little bit for, you know, making it gradual. Why was there a big debate about it when Gould and his friend, you know, proposed it? It was because it,
and Eldridge,
it went, yeah. Anyway, so...
Because everything's debated in science. That's how it works.
It's the evolutionists that have actually said that it's the a geological instant, and used those phrases and called it the evolution's Big Bang. Time magazine, just within the last 7-8 years, had a cover story, Evolution's Big Bang. I have a copy of it somewhere.
Yeah, but you got to put that into context. That's 10 million
years.
Well,
that's good.
Yeah.
I know. Let's put it into context, and let's let the kids look at it, and they can decide, is it strong or weak? To me, it's great to discuss. You know,
you still haven't made your case as to why you think it's weak, though.
Because it doesn't fit the pattern. Charles Darwin, when he looked at the fossil record, thought it would be just an interminable number of fossils. When they find, you know, he said that was the greatest argument against his theory.
Well, but so yeah, sure. The fossil record was very scant when Darwin was proposing his theory. We didn't even discover genes yet. I mean, there have been tremendous scientific discoveries in the last 150 years. Evolution has weathered all of those discoveries quite nicely, actually. And the fossil record, it's always going to be incomplete, always going to be gaps, but 150 years of collecting fossils since Darwin's theory of evolution has only supported common ancestry and this change in species over time. It supports evolution. But when we're talking about what you're characterizing as sudden appearance and stasis, that's a tweak. That's just, now that we have more fossils to look at, we could see that it's not this continuous gradual change, but it's more rapid change followed by equilibrium. That's just an adjustment of the theory to better fit increasing evidence. It does, and does not call into question whether or not life evolved, only the pattern of evolution as it occurs.
Okay, so that's fine with me. If that's what it is, we make the arguments. that's exactly what our new standards get to do. They get to look and show, well, we've got very strong evidence that shows that, then that's fine. It, make the case. It, that's why I think Fordham, in their report about it, our high school biology standards being probably some of the best in the nation, the ones that I tweaked, the ones that where we added the, you know, the challenges to evolution about the fossil record and complexity of the cell, they found them good. And I think that's what our students get to hear. They get to hear Steve make that argument. And then they get to hear somebody else say, well, you know, I don't see it that way. That's, to me, that's not strong enough.
Well, Don, we really thank you for agreeing to be interviewed on our show. You're a good sport, and I thought it was a very interesting discussion.
Well, I enjoyed it. I love to talk about this. I mean, I it's a real privilege to be on your show, and I'm going to start listening to your podcast.
Okay, that sounds great.
And we should mention that if people want to see more of Don, you can see it on The Revisionaries, which is out on Netflix right now, and can also be you can order a DVD on Amazon or on their website at therevisionariesmovie.com.
All right, thanks again, Don.
Thanks, Don.
Hey, thank you all.
It's time for Science or Fiction.
Each week, I come up with three science news items or facts, two genuine and one fictitious. Then I challenge my panel of skeptics to tell me which one is the fake. You guys ready for this week?
Let's do it.
Yep.
Yes. Do we have a theme this week?
The theme is there is no theme.
I like it.
The theme with no name.
Here we go. Just three news items. Item number one, a new study finds that men who marry younger women are less intelligent, less attractive, and less wealthy than men who marry women closer in age.
Uh-huh.
Item number two, researchers have developed an intelligent nano-network drug release system that can effectively control blood sugar in diabetics for 1 week from a single injection. And item number three, new evidence suggests that toothbrushes are a major source of outbreaks of strep throat and other respiratory infections. Jay, go first.
All right.
You found this so amusing.
The first one is very funny. So the idea that men who marry younger women are less intelligent, less attractive, and less wealthy than men who marry women closer to their age. For some reason, all three of those reasons seem counterintuitive. However, this one doesn't seem to be fake to me for some reason. I mean, how the hell would I know any other way other than what my gut tells me about that? And I certainly didn't read this. But the second one about the intelligent nano-network drug release system. Nano-network drug release system sounds completely bogus to me. But Perry did say that any science or fiction that has nano in it has to be true. And I will follow that rule to the day I die. And the last one, new evidence suggests that the toothbrushes are a major source of outbreaks, strep throat. That one seems legitimate. Wait, what? You're using somebody else's toothbrush in your house?
I don't think that's what it means, but don't let me stop you.
Why? How? Like, nobody's spitting on them in the factory. How is the disease getting transmitted? You can't give it to yourself, can you? Or is it just caught, like, is it floating around in the air and it collects on the wet toothbrush? I mean, I don't know. It just doesn't sound legit either. So this is a good one, Steve. I'm going to say the toothbrush one is the fake.
Okay, Rebecca?
So I don't know. This is good because none of these are familiar to me, but I did read an article recently about back pain and about how 40% of all back pain could be cured through a course of antibiotics. And what they were saying was that microbes can enter the bloodstream through toothbrushing. And so I can see how, you know, that could also apply to strep throat. It could take. I think it could spread bacteria and stuff into your system, I guess. So I don't know. That sounds believable to me. The nano drug release system for diabetics also sounds believable to me. Again, because of another news item I read. I didn't read about this, but a similar treatment, HIV, like an HIV treatment. So yeah, I can believe that nano stuff being used to treat diseases quickly and effectively can work and show at least show promise. So yeah, just by process of elimination, that means that maybe men who marry younger women are not less intelligent, less attractive, and less wealthy. So I'm gonna stick up for Jay here, and I'm gonna say that one is the fiction.
Okay, Evan.
Well, the toothbrush one, I'll say is science. The nanonetwork drug release system, effectively controlling blood sugar in diabetics for a week on a single injection. Fascinating stuff. The men who marry younger women are less intelligent. I don't think that one's right. Something is wrong here, especially when you make the comparison, and less wealthy than men who marry women closer in age. Well, we're talking comparing closer in age versus men marrying younger women. They're kind of, the degrees are kind of nebulous here. So I'm thinking that that perhaps is a reason to call that one the fiction. That's why I'll choose that one as the fiction.
And Bob.
Okay, the nano network drug release. Yeah, I've been waiting for that for a long time. It's about time. Like
Yawn.
At least since 1992, Bob.
About time, yeah, doctors. Least.
Right. Yeah, I've got very little problem believing that. Slow release of insulin, whatever. It's great. About time. Took you long enough. The men marrying younger women. That doesn't sound right to me. I mean, I'm not sure what to make of that. I suspect it probably has to do with the prevalence of social situations in which people are of similar age and situations where there's a big difference in age. I don't know. But the big problem, the one that really leaps at me though, is the toothbrush one. People don't share toothbrushes. People don't even like putting their toothbrushes near other toothbrushes. I just don't think that would be a major source of outbreaks of strep throat and other respiratory infections. I think we would have known about it before now. So I've got a biggest problem with that one. So I'm going to go with the toothbrushes as fiction.
Okay, so interestingly, Bob and Jay think the toothbrush one is fiction, while Rebecca and Evan think that the men marrying younger women is fiction.
So interesting.
We did all go the opposite, didn't we? of what stereotypically we should have gone.
Right. Yeah, because Rebecca never brushes her teeth.
Secrets on the show.
So you all agree, however, that researchers have developed an intelligent nano-network drug release system that can effectively control blood sugar in diabetics for 1 week from a single injection.
Uh-oh.
All think that one is true.
Yeah, uh-oh, Jay.
And that one is science.
Ah.
Wow. Nano, what's going on with this
one?
Yeah,
baby.
Cool. Steve. Of course, Jay, you know I'm going to have a nano one that's fiction someday just because to break your rule.
You would, wait. Well, first off, that's Perry's rule, and you would do that to Perry?
I'm not saying. So yeah, this is cool. I was really, this headline got me. It's like, wow, that's one fantastic injection and it controls blood sugar for a week. That's awesome. Imagine going from having to inject yourself three times a day to once a week.
Yeah.
But the cool thing is that this smart system actually releases insulin responding to changes in blood sugar.
Ah, that's the key one.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
That's fantastic.
So it's not just a slow release system that's just, trickling insulin into the system. It's actually responding to the level of blood sugar in the body. Now, this has only been tested in mice.
Oh.
One injection was able to maintain blood sugar levels in the normal range for up to 10 days. They said a week to be conservative. So this still has to go through some development to be approved in humans. But maybe, who knows, 3, 4, 5 years from now, this could become standard therapy. And this would be a huge boon to insulin-dependent diabetics.
Think about the drop in injections, Steve. We're talking, if it's 3 a day, we're talking, 1,000 injections a year compared to 52?
Yeah.
Holy crap.
How do you figure that out?
That's incredible.
All right. So let's go to number one. A new study finds that men who marry younger women are less intelligent, less attractive, and less wealthy than men who marry women closer in age. Evan and Rebecca, you think this one is the fiction, and this one is science.
Wow.
I don't know who should be more disappointed, me and Evan or Bob and Jay.
Yeah.
For a little context here, Jay's wife is a little younger than him. And, we'll leave it at that.
Wait, well, hold on. I'm the guy you're going to talk about?
Let me put it this way, Jay.
You're the safe bet.
You're the one
Jay,
I'm willing
hell,
to talk
Jay, you
about.
You didn't get that.
You're the
Enjoy
one I'm
your
willing
victory,
to talk
Jay.
About.
Enjoy the victory.
All right. This survey showed, in fact, that this is true pretty much for men and women and for spouses that are younger or older. It's essentially...
Wait, you're saying that this was a self-report survey?
No.
Like,
no.
How dumb are you?
No.
Very dumb.
I didn't say self-report. I'm just saying it's not just women younger than men.
But you called it a survey.
The findings were not based on just a self-survey. It was based upon... They examined U.S. Census Bureau data from 1960 to 2000, looking at age of first marriage, completed education, occupational wages, and earnings, and also used a 1979 National Longitudinal Survey of Youth to measure cognitive skills and the National Longitudinal Survey of Adolescent Health to gauge physical attractiveness. So obviously, you know, not absolutely ironclad, but they
especially
used
when it comes to
could.
Physical attractiveness.
Of course, it's ultimately subjective, but you knew
that. I mean, don't
get
me wrong. I completely 100% believe this.
But, you know, I mean, you knew that going in. Less attractive is subjective. But that's they used as an objective source as they could, I guess. So, and Evan, there isn't a cutoff because it is all relative. It's just that the effect holds up throughout the spectrum. The younger or older the relative age of the spouse, the greater the effect.
Okay.
So,
travels along with it.
Yeah. They said the possible exception is women married to older men. But other than that, it pretty much held up. Definitely was true for men marrying younger women.
Wait, what?
Older women married to younger men.
You messed it up.
Yeah, because that just directly contradicted your thing. So I think you must.
It's not true for the women. In other words, the women who are married to older men are not less intelligent, less attractive, and less wealthy. But the men who are married to younger women or older women are, and women married to younger men are, but not necessarily women married to older men.
Wait, so men who are married to older women are also less attractive?
Yes.
So.
Why?
Okay, so all men except for the men who marry people the same exact age.
We're close. The closer in age.
Wow.
It's all about propinquity. Propinquity.
I love that word.
Which fits.
That's a good word.
Psychological studies. Propinquity is everything. The people that we end up liking are people that we are exposed to. You think that you sort your friends based upon personality, whatever. Nope. It's all who you're next to. That's who we become friends with.
You choose from that lot. It's a finite lot that you have to choose from.
Yeah, but it's not just that, Evan. It really is that determines who you end up socializing with. It's just who
you're
exposed
to. What about all these people around me that I hate?
Yeah.
Well, that's right. That's the other point.
I don't believe in that, Steve. I mean,
you don't believe in evidence?
Or science.
Ouch.
Your quibble is not with me, sir, but with science. Jay, what are you saying? You don't believe that propinquity is the dominant factor in determining social connections?
Yes.
Okay.
Well,
how does
digital propinquity play into it?
Explain that. Zero. What about online friends, Steve?
It's a brave new world. I'm talking about classic psychological studies.
Oh, isn't that convenient?
Pre-internet.
So this survey is already out of date. Next.
Oh, God.
About this survey. I'm talking about other older psychological studies that also show this effect. Anyway.
Steve, I think you have a propinquity for being authoritative. Thank you.
What this study found was that the people who are of lower economic status.
Oh, here we go.
Tend to get into jobs where the age range is greater. Whereas people who tend to have higher socioeconomic status, higher education, tend to get into careers where they are more likely to be associated with people of the same age. And the big factor there is simply college. People who go to college will end up, marrying from people they meet at college who are likely to be close to their age.
Again, I hated everybody at college, so I'm the exception that proves the rule here.
People people who don't go into college, who get a high school education and then go into the workforce are likely to be in a workforce when they're of marriageable age, they're likely to be exposed to people of different ages.
And I am not misusing that phrase. I know exactly what it means and I use it correctly.
Rebecca, are you saying we didn't lose this week?
No, we definitely lost.
You definitely lost.
Nah, too bad.
Because new evidence suggests that toothbrushes are a major source of outbreaks of strep throat and other respiratory infections is the fiction.
Fiction.
And the study that I based this on actually showed the exact opposite of that. What they did was they took brand spanking new toothbrushes right out of the package and cultured them for all kinds of bacteria. And then they had people brush their teeth with toothbrushes, including people who were infected with strep throat, people who had other infections, and then healthy controls. And then they tried to see what they could culture from the toothbrushes. And what they found was basically no correlation. They only cultured strep throat from one toothbrush, and it was one that was used by a healthy control, not one of the people who actually had strep throat. And they actually cultured a couple of infectious bacteria from the toothbrushes that came right out of the package that were not even used by anybody.
How's that possible?
Well, yeah, contamination happens.
Contamination happens, absolutely. They removed them sterilely. They tried to use good technique, but it's possible, I guess, that the contamination came as part of the process, not on the toothbrush before it was packaged. But it could also have been, who knows how pristinely sterile the factories are that make toothbrushes. Stray bacteria getting in there is not unheard of.
That's why I brush with bleach the first time.
Yeah. Well, I always thoroughly clean my toothbrush before I brush every day. I run it under water we keep our water out of the tap pretty hot, and I always run it under there for a little bit before I use it.
Makes sense.
I don't know how effective it is, but it makes me feel better.
It washes off that fecal matter.
Exactly. Because it is everywhere. If you look for it, you'll find it. And so are bacteria. If you look for it, it's pretty much everywhere.
The bugs win.
Hey, I'm going to be at
what?
Women in Secularism, May 17th through 19th, and you can still get tickets at womeninsecularism.org. It's in Washington, D.C., and it's going to be a lot of fun, and dudes can come if they want.
I was going to say.
Dudes can come?
Yep. Yeah. Dudes,
my
ladies,
Y chromosome, right.
People who identify as things other than dudes and ladies.
When does it take place?
May 17th through 19th in D.C. You should come.
Washington, D.C.
We're going to have a good time.
Jay, you got a quote for us?
I do have a quote. It was sent in by a listener named Tormod Steinschult.
Steinschult.
Yabos.
this is an excellent quote by author David Brin.
Ooh, I love David Brin.
Ooh, he's awesome. Uplift Wars.
Dune?
Yeah, and the quote
is Dune. Uplift Wars. Very good.
Gotcha. Okay, all right.
Young guys that can get really young, hot girlfriends or younger hot girlfriends.
And breed with them.
And then have sex with them are actually smart, rich, and pretty damn awesome. Ladies and gentlemen, David Brin.
And skeptical.
QED. Nice.
I believe that.
Okay. Science!
Makes sense. So,
David Brin wrote, "For all its beauty, honesty, and effectiveness at improving the human condition, science demands a terrible price, that we accept what experiments tell us about the universe, whether or not we like it. It's about consensus and teamwork and respectful critical argument working with and through natural law. It requires that we utter frequently those hateful words, I might be wrong."
Absolutely.
That's a great quote.
Mm-hmm. That was cool.
Very nice.
David Brin! I was on episode 26 of Atheist Nomads. So go to atheistnomads.com and check it out. I really went off the rails with these guys. So if you want to find out how insane I am, take a listen.
Off the rails and
the stuff
the
that I would edit out. All right, guys. Thanks for joining me this week.
Thank you, Steve.
My pleasure, Steve.
Thank you, Steve.
And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at theskepticsguide.org, where you will find the show notes as well as links to our blogs, videos, online forum, and other content. You can send us feedback or questions to info@theskepticsguide.org. Also, please consider supporting the SGU by visiting the store page on our website, where you will find merchandise, premium content, and subscription information. Our listeners are what make SGU possible. We'll be right back.